Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Mike Pence is campaigning in New Hampshire today. We'll check in on the presidential race in the Granite State and how it's affecting a hotly contested Senate race. Also today, the influence of social media on this election season.
A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
We'll look at how it's transforming campaign strategy and voter engagement. Plus, the Department of Justice announces that it will stop using private prisons. And female athletes are turning in one astounding performance after the other in these Olympics. So why do we keep getting moments like these?
And there's the guy responsible for turning Katinka Hotsu, his wife, into a whole different swimmer.
We'll talk about sexism and Olympic coverage next on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence is campaigning in Manchester, New Hampshire today. He talked about law enforcement, foreign policy, and the economy.
There's a lot of Americans, a lot of hardworking Hoosiers, a lot of hardworking people in New Hampshire who know we can do better. The truth is, we know this is nowhere near the best we can do. It's just the best they can do.
Well, a CBS News YouGov poll last week put the Trump-Pence ticket 9 points behind Democrats Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine. And many in New Hampshire are looking even further down the ticket to see what effect this presidential race might be having on a very tight New Hampshire Senate race between Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, the incumbent, and Democratic governor and challenger Maggie Hassan. Well, joining us now is Trent Spinner. He's executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, and he's on the line with us from New Hampshire. Trent, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So Governor Pence is in New Hampshire today. Clearly, the Trump campaign views New Hampshire as an important battleground state. Of course, Donald Trump won the New Hampshire primary. How are things looking for the Trump-Pence ticket in the Granite State?
Well, New Hampshire is always difficult to tell. You'll see polls, especially from national outlets, that are trying to call the race in New Hampshire. What we've learned here is that you really never know until Election Day. Obviously, the Trump-Pence ticket, they're down in New Hampshire, but there's still a long way to go here. And don't forget, looking back before the primary, Hillary Clinton was winning for a long time before Bernie Sanders. So we don't take much stock in the polls, and you know, out on the street, there's a lot of people talking about this race. That's for sure.
Okay, so Granite State voters may be famous for holding their cards close to their chest until Election Day. But so let's talk about what's actually happening on the ground there in New Hampshire. There has been a lot of reporting about the lack of field offices for the Trump campaign and infrastructure in key swing states. Is that true in New Hampshire?
That's right in New Hampshire. I mean, I just Google Manchester, New Hampshire Trump office, and it's very difficult to find just simple things like where can I come pick up a lawn sign for the Trump campaign versus the Clinton campaign, which has they've coordinated offices with the Democratic Party. There are more than a dozen offices open in the state right now. So the Clinton campaign definitely has an advantage in terms of the ground game, in terms of people being able to directly connect with the campaign by walking into an office or volunteering. But here's the really important thing to consider is that Trump showed us in the primary that you don't really need that. He was able to reach right over the heads of the media, reach directly past all that kind of nitty-gritty logistical stuff, and directly connect with voters either through his Twitter account or television time. So, yes, does the Clinton campaign have an advantage in terms of the ground game? Absolutely. But I think you can't discredit Trump's ability to reach a lot of people very quickly.
I see. Now, I take your point about maybe having taking a grain of salt with polling in New Hampshire, but that CBS News YouGov poll that we talked about, that I mentioned at the top of the conversation, had a really interesting sort of crosstab here. It found that close to 90% of respondents to the poll already felt strongly or very strongly about their choice for president. So the people who were behind Clinton are behind her through and through. The people who are behind Trump are behind him through and through. Does that mean that, I mean, but what does that mean about those folks who are undecided? I mean, what does that mean for Trump's, possibilities in the Granite State?
Well, I think that's interesting. I think 90% may even be a low number because I was at a Rotary breakfast this morning, and the very first thing I said while I still had everyone's attention, I said, can you just raise your hand if you are truly an undecided voter between Trump and Clinton? And I would say about 5% of the audience was actually undecided. So what does that mean? It means for both of these campaigns that they're going to have to target those voters, and it's a very small number of people. They're going to have to target those voters. They're going to have to find them and then try to convince them. That's a difficult thing to do in New Hampshire, where people, as you mentioned, like to hold their cards close to the vest. They don't really like to talk publicly too much about who they're voting for. So I think that whoever has the advantage in terms of technology to find those voters, to convince those voters, and then to turn out that 90 or 95% who have already made up their minds,
yeah.
I think you'll see that those are the people that whichever campaign is able to do that, they're the ones who are going to take this home. Yeah.
Well, we've got to talk about what effect this is all having on, in a way, the more fascinating Senate race in New Hampshire between Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan. Again, I'm looking at polls because that's the data that I've got at my fingertips here. We've got that CBS News YouGov poll, the most recent one from last week, has it at Maggie Hassan up by 1 point. So it's so very, very tight. Would we have expected the race to be as tight if the presidential race weren't what it is?
I think so. This is a blockbuster race. This is a Senate seat that we all knew would be up for grabs. We knew that there'd be a lot of outside money coming into this race. We're talking about probably $100 million Senate race. We have a very popular former attorney general who went on to the Senate. We have a very popular governor, and they are. I mean, this is really a match for the ages. I think the polls can't call this one because it really is so close. And I think for both of these women, it's going to be interesting to see just how much of an impact the national races will have. When I'm out talking to people, I hear a lot of folks who are saying, I've been a lifelong Republican, but I cannot vote for Donald Trump. So they're going to vote for either no one in the presidential race and Kelly Ayotte. And then I also hear from Democrats who say, I was a huge Bernie Sanders supporter, and they don't really want to vote for Clinton. So, in New Hampshire, it's really hard to nail down the electorate. And
right.
So the amount of impact the presidential race will have on the Senate race is really a question mark.
Well, if I just can jump in here, Trent, for a second, because this is absolutely a question mark that has been making itself known in terms of how the media is engaging with Senator Ayotte. I mean, she was asked just earlier this week if, she would endorse Donald Trump. And CNN's Manu Raju asked her that. And here's how Senator Ayotte responded.
I've actually said that I'm going to be voting for him. But I do have significant disagreements with him, which I've been very clear on. So I won't be endorsing him.
But what's the distinction between endorsing and voting?
There's actually a big distinction because everyone gets a vote. And, but an endorsement is one where I'm out campaigning with someone. And so while he has my vote, he doesn't have my endorsement.
Well, so this is a delicate dance that a lot of Republican senators further down the ticket are having to do this time around. I mean, I guess my last question to you, Trent, is how much does that sort of navigation that we heard Kelly Ayotte try to pull off, how much is that going to matter to New Hampshire voters?
I think it's going to matter a lot. Don't forget, we were the outlet who first reported her now famous quote, I'm going to support him but not endorse him.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the dictionary definition of the word endorse is an act of giving one's public approval or support. So, look, Donald Trump won with more than 100,000 votes in New Hampshire. Kelly Ayotte needs a very large chunk of those to win the Senate race. She's in a primary where Jim Rubens, who's running against her, is a big Trump supporter, even though he said a year ago he wouldn't support Trump. But that's another story. So she's really kind of fighting from both sides here. So she needs those Trump voters at least to get her through the primary, but she also doesn't want to be too close to Trump because she needs some of those more moderates who might vote for Hassan to vote for her. So
right.
It's a tricky road for her.
Very, very tricky. Well, Trent Spinner is executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader, giving us an on-the-ground look at both the Senate and presidential races in the Granite State. It was great to have you, Trent. Thanks so very much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, Mike Pence is campaigning in New Hampshire today. Meanwhile, the man at the top of the ticket tweeted earlier today, quote, "They will soon be calling me Mr. Brexit." All caps on the Mr. Brexit. The Twitterverse was confused, and the Washington Post threw up a headline saying, quote, "Donald Trump just called himself Mr. Brexit and nobody knows why," but then offered the interpretation that the UK surprised the world by voting to leave the European Union, despite polling that indicated otherwise, so perhaps Mr. Trump is saying he'll surprise the world the same way in November. Well, over at Hillary Clinton's Twitter account, she tweeted today, "We know that giving millionaires huge tax breaks doesn't help our economy, so why would we try it again, Donald?" Striking a provocative personal tone, which, of course, Donald Trump frequently does on his Twitter account as well. Now, the point of all this? We are in an era where social media is driving political narrative. It's transforming how elections are done. So what effect is that having on our democracy? Well, Nico Maley and Amy Mitchell have considered this question deeply. Nico is the director of the Shorenstein Center of Media, Politics, and Public Policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's a pleasure to be here, Meghna.
And Amy Mitchell is director of journalism research at the Pew Research Center. Amy, great to have you as well.
Good to be here. Thanks.
So let me just start with a quick question to both of you. And Nico, I'll just turn to you first. We've had Twitter, obviously, in election cycles in the past. But are we seeing it play a different or more intense role this time around?
Well, we actually haven't had Twitter in that many election cycles. Barack Obama announced he was running for president in 2007 before Twitter was launched. And it really only got started in kind of popular use in the 2012 presidential cycle. Mm-hmm. So I'd argue it's still a pretty new medium for presidential politics. Not to mention that smartphones, the ability to tweet from your phone is a pretty new innovation in and of itself.
Right. And so, Amy, I think I saw a number somewhere floating around that perhaps this time around in 2016, we have more people who say they're getting information about the election through social media than conventional news sources. Is that true?
Certainly than some conventional news sources. I'm not sure what that number was, but we find that social media now is among the mainstream ways that people are following the election as well as following news in general, often outpacing print newspapers for sure. Cable news does tend still to be the primary way that most Americans are learning about the election in particular, but social media is right up there, and we have some new data on people that are turning directly to the Clinton or Trump social media feeds for news about the election. We're at about a quarter of the American public, the U.S. adult population at this point, that are turning directly to those kinds of posts for election news.
Okay, interesting. So Nico, then how much does this matter? Let's just get right to the heart of the question that, I sort of posed rhetorically in the intro. I mean, what effect is the new large role that social media is playing? What effect is that having on this election?
I think we've seen it had a pretty substantial effect in three main ways. The first is that Trump has definitely used his Twitter account to shape the conversation, to drive the news cycle. He used it brilliantly in the primaries in order to divert coverage away from things he didn't want people to pay attention to. Sometimes it was his opponents. And he uses it to go on the attack and to try and change the narrative with great frequency. I think the tweet you mentioned in the opening about he's Mr. Brexit, well, he's in the middle of a spat of negative news coverage about his shakeup at the top of his campaign again, and he wants to change the narrative. narrative. He wants people talking about something else other than his faults and weaknesses. He's trying to use Twitter to shape that conversation, really as an alternative almost to holding a press conference or press availability.
Huh. Amy, your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's been really interesting to look at how the two candidates are using social media differently, both in, you know, certainly a controlling manner in terms of controlling their message, using it to put out the kind of message they want. But we have found in the posts that Trump and his campaign are putting out, he's often, if he's linking to news media or he's linking to other kinds of sources. He tends to retweet citizens more than he retweets other kinds of sources. The Clinton campaign, on the other hand, is largely keeping things insular. They are circling back, linking back to things that are on the campaign website pages, linking and retweeting things that the campaign has put out on their own. So taking a different strategy in the kind of information sources they're using, that very much making it a part of their messaging and their information flow out to the public.
Yeah, and Nico, have you noticed those similar types of differences between the Trump and Clinton campaigns' use of social media?
Absolutely, and in fact, looking at Trump's own tweets, it's very clear that his tweets are coming from two different phones. There's one is an iPhone, and then there's another phone that's an Android phone. And we know that Trump himself has been photographed using an Android Galaxy smartphone, and most of the tweets that talk about crooked Hillary, most of the tweets that talk about the dishonest media come from the Android phone.
Right. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about Twitter because, of course, Donald Trump is especially active on Twitter. But there's all sorts of different social media platforms, as we all know, Facebook, Instagram, et cetera, to name a few. I mean, Amy, I'm wondering what you think about how in terms of campaigns reaching out directly to voters and creating a new kind of voter engagement. Because I was thinking it was just recently in the past week or so where Hillary Clinton's campaign released a podcast with an interview, and I put the words interview in quotes because it was a campaign release podcast, but a long conversation with Hillary Clinton in that podcast. And this comes at a time where the Clinton campaign is under constant criticism from media outlets for not doing enough press conferences. So it's a completely different kind of engagement that once again does that end run around conventional media and conventional journalists who seek that same access to the candidate. So how much is that sort of changing how we were understanding this campaign?
Well, you know, we've certainly been seeing over the last, you know, three presidential election cycles, really, campaigns trying to figure out how do we use technology, how do we use these tools to connect directly to voters and to members of the public, in many cases looking to bypass the traditional media and have a direct relationship with the public. In 2008, as Nico mentioned earlier, when social media was really just beginning, we had less than a quarter of the public that was using social media at all. We did have developments in that space. And at that point, it was a lot of like, how many different platforms can I possibly be on? In the study that we did that year, John Edwards had surpassed all the other candidates in the primary with 23 separate places that people could connect with him that were listed on the campaign website. That was a year where MySpace was big, Flickr was big, Meetup. Obama had the most friends on MySpace. But if you look at the overall numbers there, it's still, you know, it's relatively small, about 400,000 that were his friends on MySpace when you compare it to the kind of numbers we're seeing today. But, you know, again, a lot of different types of experimentation. 2008 was the big year of the blogs.
Right.
And that was a year where actually we even saw more experimentation with giving the public a little more control over the message. So 7 of the 19 sites that we studied actually encouraged supporters to start their own blogs that were officially connected to the campaign.
Even in back in 2003, 2004, I worked on the Dean campaign, and Howard Dean's ability to be competitive in the primary in 2003 was really built around his use of blogs and what at the time was called the Netroots, which was, I'd say, an earlier manifestation of social media. And on the conservative side in that race, the swift boat attack against John Kerry really started on conservative blogs in 2004. And so I think you can see that for decades you'd have the media and the political establishment kind of duke it out to create a campaign narrative for the public. But I think that beginning in the 2003-04 presidential cycle, we saw the emergence of the internet, broadly speaking, as taking a role in crafting that narrative. That process got opened up for the first time, and the role of the gatekeepers began to be eroded. And in some sense, Donald Trump is the, you know, is the ultimate erosion of gatekeeping.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, he's the vanguard of a full scale rejection of those typical gatekeepers. I do wonder, though. There's a lot of different ways to measure engagement, right, on social media, on the various platforms. But the ultimate measure of success is, you know, who goes to the polls and how they vote on election day. Do we have any sense from, you know, previous elections, even though, Nico, I take your point that we're only maybe a couple election cycles into seeing how important social media is, but how much engagement online is then translated into actual voting, Amy? Do we have any sense of that?
You know, that's something that we'll have to continue to watch to see. Now that we have so much of the public that, you know, it's now more than half, 62% of the public that are getting some news on social media, 84% of your 18 to 29-year-olds. So it's touching a lot of people. And, you know, the degree to which we can start to slice that and look at where your, you know, stronger voting population is one that's likely to have, they're likely to have got news on a lot of different platforms. When we ask about election news following, we still have a solid portion of the public that are getting election news on five or more different types of sources. So there's often a fairly wide mix. It's your young people that tend to be more concentrated around social media at this point.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the 2010 midterm election, we actually had one of the largest social science experiments ever conducted in cooperation with Facebook. An academic, James Fowler at UC San Diego, took everyone on Facebook at the time, about 64 million Americans, and ran different messages to them on Facebook to try and figure out via a controlled academic experiment if you could increase turnout with Facebook. And sure enough, one of the findings of the study was that if Facebook showed you a message that said, these are your friends who have voted, that slightly increased the likelihood you would vote.
Wow. Okay. Well, finally, I'm curious to hear from both of you about sort of a philosophical concern, which always comes into play when we talk about social media, because there are a lot of people out there who say, yes, we might get more and more engagement with every election cycle that passes. But the pitfall of social media is that you can also sort of enter that echo chamber, that we might have more engagement, but people are getting a narrower buffet of points of view because of all those algorithms that are shaping what shows up on our Twitter feeds and Facebook, et cetera. I guess I'm just sort of asking from a data perspective, do we know that's happening, or is that a legitimate concern, Nico?
I think it's definitely a legitimate yeah. concern, yeah. but we just don't have enough information to know how big of a concern it should be and what kind of impact it might be having. You know, people consume a wide range of media. They listen to the radio. They watch cable TV. Social media is just one part of their media diet for the most part. And frequently people have some sense of the implicit choices involved in the kind of media they're consuming.
Yeah, I mean, we're starting to get some nuggets of insight into this space, but there is still a lot more to learn. And one of the challenges is that the very dynamics of social media mean the impact and influence is going to differ for every single individual mm-hmm. because it's going to depend on the makeup of their networks, on who the friends are in their networks, on what their behavior is and how the algorithm responds to that. We have found in our past research that those that are the most politically aligned, so they're the most consistently aligned with one ideology or another, tend to be those that are most likely to have networks that reinforce their own
right.
views politically. Most people still, even those that are on those edges, still see a mix of views to a certain extent, but they're more likely to have a larger portion of those that are reinforcing. We also have found in our, and that carries through to the people you
yeah.
talk about politics with also. It's not just in the social network chamber.
Yeah.
We did find when we asked people about following the social media post of Trump or Clinton that there is, you know, that there is some counter-following going on. So we had about 13% of Clinton supporters that were turning to Trump social media posts, and about the same percentage, 10% of Trump supporters turning to social media posts for Clinton.
So some crossover there.
Some crossover there.
Well, Amy Mitchell is Director of Journalism Research at the Pew Research Center. She spoke to us today from Washington. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you.
And Nico Maley, Director of the Shorenstein Center of Media Politics and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'll see you on Twitter.
See you on Twitter. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakravarti. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Department of Justice is planning to phase out the use of privately run federal prisons. In a memo today, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates said the private facilities don't provide the same level of services, don't save substantially on costs, and do not maintain the same level of safety and security as government-run prisons. Well, for more on this now, we're joined by Beth Schwartz-Apfel. She's a staff writer at the Marshall Project. It's a not-for-profit news and analysis site that covers criminal justice in America. Beth, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Meghna.
All right, so we don't have a ton of details from the Department of Justice on today's announcement. So, but what do we know about specifically what the DOJ is proposing?
Basically, what you just said is as much as we know at the moment. As you said, the Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, directed the acting director for the Bureau of Prisons to begin to phase out the use of immigration detention facilities run by private companies. But the memo is less than 2 pages and provides almost no specifics about how exactly they're going to do that.
So wait, if I heard you correctly, immigration detention facilities?
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. No, private prisons run by the Bureau of Prisons. The reason that I mix that up is because the only federal prisoners that are held in these private prisons are non-citizens. These are citizens who commit federal crimes are held in federally run prisons. Immigrants, particularly non-citizens who commit federal crimes, are held in these separate series of facilities that are run by private companies. So
okay.
I apologize for the mix-up, but there is this very strange separate system for citizens and non-citizens.
Within the federal detention system. Okay, interesting. So, I mean, just taking a step back here, though, how significant is it that the DOJ is even saying that it's going to phase out the use of private facilities?
Well, I think as with anything that the federal government does in criminal justice, I think it's significant for the some 22,000 inmates who will no longer be held in these private prisons. But in the scheme of things, those are very small numbers compared to the number of people that are held in U.S. prisons overall, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million. So when the federal government does something like this, by and large, it's a very loud symbolic message. It sends the message that our government, our U.S. government, does not think that private prisons do what they say they're doing, namely save money and provide the same level of services. Whether the states will follow suit, that remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Now, give us some context here. What do we know about what prompted the DOJ to make this decision now?
Well, most immediately, last week, the Inspector General released a pretty scathing report finding that contract prisons, meaning prisons owned by private companies, incurred more safety and security incidents. They had higher rates of assault. They had more violence. They had more contraband. They overused solitary confinement. They provided substandard medical care. But this report came as no surprise. Everybody in the criminal justice community, saw that report came out and said, so it's something that people who have covered this have known for a long time. I think sources tell us that the reason the Inspector General finally wrote this report in the first place was there's been a series of relatively high-profile riots in these privately run prisons over the course of the last several years, most recently one last year in a facility in southern Texas that led to it being shut down. And that's coupled with an overall reduction in the number of federal prisoners. So just a few years ago, there were somewhere around 220,000 federal prisoners. Now there's less than 200,000. So the existing federal facilities can now sort of absorb all the people that were held in these private facilities, whereas if this report had come out 5 years ago, there would have been nowhere to put these people.
Uh-huh. So, but we don't necessarily have a timeline or a plan in terms of how the Department of Justice would actually affect this change.
Exactly. Yates lays out they recently declined to renew one prison contract at a facility in New Mexico. That's about 1,200 beds. And she also mentioned in her memo that they are going to substantially reduce the scope of another contract they were going to just put out, they were going to put out in the coming months. But other than that, there are no other details, and that leaves somewhere around 14,000 people, by Yates's own count, that they have not figured out yet what they're going to do with.
Right. Nevertheless, as you note and others have noted today, this is a symbolically important move by the Department of Justice. But I also note that it's President Obama's Department of Justice, and you know we will have a brand new administration as of November 9th. So you know, could all of this basically be undone by the next president?
Precisely. Yes, it could. That's a really important question. It's just a directive by the Department of Justice. So any future administration could issue a different directive and turn things around. And Donald Trump, for one, has said, and this is a quote, "I do think we can do a lot of privatizations and private prisons. It seems to work a lot better." So Hillary Clinton, too, critics have pointed out that she's had some financial ties in the past to some of these private prison companies. So, you know, she's indicated a move in the criminal justice realm towards reducing the number of prisoners. But, you know, if past is prologue, we'll see. There's no way to know what any future administration will do.
Well, Beth Schwartz-Apfel is staff writer for The Marshall Project, talking to us today about the Department of Justice's announcement that it will no longer use privately run federal prisons. Beth, thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's talk about how we talk about female Olympians. There's a trend, and it's not good. One of the first examples happened just 2 days into these Rio Games when Hungarian swimmer Katinka Hotsu won gold and broke the world record in the 400-meter individual medley. The camera turned to her husband and coach Shane Tusup. Then NBC announcer Dan Hicks said this.
And there's the guy responsible for turning Katinka Hotsu, his wife, into a whole different swimmer.
Well, over the past weeks, we've seen several more examples of female athletes being subsumed to the accomplishments of men. How about this awful headline from the San Jose Mercury News the day after Simone Manuel won gold in the 100-meter freestyle? The headline said this: Michael Phelps shares historic night with African American. Well, the paper later apologized and changed that headline. But why in 2016 is this still happening? And how can we change it? I'm interested in hearing from you. What do you make of how the media has been covering female athletes in these Olympic Games? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Well, I'm so pleased to say that joining me now are two people who know a lot about how to cover sports and how to cover female athletes. Melissa Ludke is one of them. In 1978, she was the Sports Illustrated writer who won access for women sports writers when she took Major League Baseball to federal court. She's a contributor now to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Melissa Ludke, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Also with us today from Rio is USA Today reporter Nicole Auerbach, where she's covering the Olympic Games. She's covered Olympic swimming last week. And she joins us from Brazil. Welcome to you, Nicole.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you both. So, Melissa, let me just start with you. Was I fair or going overboard in my assessment of how the media overall has been talking about female athletes in these games?
You know, I'd give you an A on that.
Oh, I'd get an A. Good.
I'd give you an A. And here's how I think about it. I'm from the 70s. That was my era. And a lot happened in the 70s. For example, Title IX was passed. So let's just look at 1975. It makes an easy round number of 40 years. I would say that the female athletes have really proven to us what can happen in 40 years in terms of their performances, their feats, their accomplishments. I would say that in terms of coverage of them, I am sadly seeing great echoes from the 1970s when I was just starting out as one of the few very pioneering women reporters.
Wow. Well, Nicole, you're in Rio, there on the ground doing this coverage for us. What has it been like for you?
Well, a lot of it, I'm sort of, us here in Rio are getting a little bit after the fact, because some of these examples have happened during the NBC telecast, so obviously
right.
I'm not watching that. But I think that there just have been examples. There was the Chicago Tribune's tweet about the wife of a Chicago Bear. I mean, the constant characterization of some of these women as how they relate to their men is something that has continually happened in female sports coverage. There's a certain tone or different things that are written about female gymnasts versus the male gymnasts. I think the backlash and the negativity that Gabby Douglas has been receiving, I think there is a gendered element to that. She's not smiling enough.
Right.
They never say that about the men. She gets criticized for not putting her hand over her heart during the national anthem. Michael Phelps laughed during the national anthem during a swimming medal ceremony, and I got a bunch of tweets from people being like, oh my God, that's so funny. Find out what he laughed about.
Right.
And it's just a complete different expectation for these women, and I think gymnastics is a pretty good example of that, because they're supposed to not grimace. You know, everything is all of these insane, super athletic, very difficult tricks that they're doing, they're supposed to smile at the end. It's supposed to look effortless, and the men are able to grunt. They're able to, you know, show that this is a lot of physical exertion.
Well, and their game faces, their serious game faces. I mean, there was a whole meme around Michael Phelps and his like serious game face. It was celebrated as like, don't mess with this guy.
Yes.
I mean, Melissa,
and Gabby Douglas is criticized for not smiling.
Exactly. So, Melissa, what is it about how female athletes are still viewed today, not obviously between other athletes, but mm-hmm. for us as a general public, that it seems like we can't talk about them just as athletes, that we have to bring their gender into the conversation. I mean, we don't have to, but that's what happens.
Well, I know Nicole hasn't been watching the NBC telecasts, but I think it's a pretty good place to start with how they defined their mission of covering the Olympics. And that was that they acknowledged that they thought they would have more women viewers. And so what that meant is that they would divide this, I mean, make it easier for women to watch, because after all, women don't really want to watch live sports. What they want to have is a narrative, a story about it.
This is what John Miller, NBC's
John
chief
Miller.
Marketing
and
executive
said.
And
when you begin with that premise, and then you take it further and look at what those narratives start to look like, there's a formula to them. With the men, it's showing them as the gritty competitor. How did they get to achieve what they've achieved? With the female, there is always a part to this narrative story that Sally Jenkins, the Washington Post columnist, calls sort of the harlequin scenario. There's always, I want to put the gauze over it while mm-hmm. I'm watching it, because it always has to be about what also makes this athlete female. She cannot not just be seen as an athlete training for an athletic competition, but how in her personal life has she been able to do that?
Yeah.
And we start with that narrative. It's very difficult when you're presenting that narrative all the time for the audience to get themselves out of that, because they get trained almost to see people in this way.
Well, I mean, so NBC, as you mentioned, has been front and center in saying that they're going to prize narrative over actual
yes.
athletic accomplishment. I mean, John Miller's full quote, he said, more women watch the games than men, and for women, they're less interested in the result and more interested in the journey. It's sort of like the ultimate reality show and miniseries wrapped up into one. A lot of people took exception with that. Nicole, I'm wondering, when you're writing, is there a pressure or an expectation that when you're writing about female athletes that there has to be some sort of narrative involved?
No, and I think that's what female sports writers took great offense mm-hmm. to, and female sports fans. I mean, I can't, you know, you go to the bar to watch Sunday NFL games, there's a bunch of women who are wearing not a pink jersey, the regular colored jersey of their favorite team, and they're diehards, and they couldn't care less about any backstories. But I think a lot of the ways that really interesting stories are told, especially at the Olympics, are about those backstories, not necessarily, you know, a cookie-cutter narrative, but everyone has fascinating backstories. Michael Phelps has a fascinating backstory at this Olympics. So I go into it, regardless of gender, trying to tell those stories because mm-hmm. I always, when I approach my writing, I always think, you know, my mom loves sports. Like, she plays tennis still. She coached my softball teams. But she's not going to read a story. The way I would always say it was, she's not going to read a story about Derek Jeter's batting average going up by 30 points. She's going to read a story about Derek Jeter the person. I know it's a terrible example because we never got to learn too much about his personal life, but it's that sort of approach I take to every athlete, especially at an Olympic Games where there's a lot that fly under the radar. But one thing I think helps guard me against doing what we're talking about and framing things a certain way is because I am a female who loves sports. I am a woman who writes about both genders. And I think that that honestly is the root of the problem here is that, you know, every year these studies come out and it's just women are so underrepresented in sports coverage as writers, as subjects of it, as experts tied to issues around these sports, and that ends up helping to frame the issue
right.
because, you know, you have all the men creating the narrative.
Right. No, Melissa, you have something to say about this.
I was going to say, back in my day, back in that time, 40 years ago, every newsroom wanted one of us. They wanted one woman. They felt like they needed that. It was sort of a protection against legal issues that might come their way if they didn't have one of us writing. You know, I'm kind of reminded of that almost now when I look at the statistics, because the recent gender report card that came out tells us that among sports editors, only 8.5% are women.
Uh-huh.
Among women who are sports columnists, it's 12%. That is a very tiny, tiny number. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm so glad Nicole's reading her stories and I'm reading her stuff.
Yeah.
And I find that she's absolutely right. You know, anyone wants a good story well told. But what I was making the point as is, what's the formula for these stories? Just got off the phone this morning with a Steve Fox, who used to be a sportscaster himself, now teaches journalism. So he's really trying to work with youngsters to try to help them to do this. And he was really saying that most of his class is men, young men. And he said he's really been disheartened by this same thing that he's seeing in the Olympics happening in his classroom. And he was calling me because he's writing a piece now to try to put out there for other people who are teaching journalism how to get at some of this very young and how to make the changes in the journalism classes that may lead us to a place where even if these percentages stay the same, that the men who are doing it will become more conscious.
Well, so let's talk about that for a second, because we're talking about how the media and how we as a culture talk about female athletes. I mean, these are women at the pinnacle of each of their sports and chosen fields. We're joined today by Melissa Ludke. She's a journalist, and back in 1970, and she's a groundbreaking journalist, I should say, back in 1978 as a reporter for Sports Illustrated. She won equal access for female sports writers when she took Major League Baseball to federal court. She's WBUR contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. We're also joined by Nicole Auerbach. She's in Rio. She's USA Today's Sports National College Basketball reporter. She's been reporting on Olympic swimming. On the picking up of what you just said about changing how journalists talk about the coverage itself, there was a great moment in the coverage of these games where former USA Olympian and current NBC commentator Rowdy Gaines said something last Sunday, because a lot of people had been quote-unquote complimenting Katie Ledecky for swimming like a man because she's so good that that meant she had to be swimming like a man. Rowdy Gaines pushed back against that after Katie Ledecky beat her own world record in the 400-meter freestyle. And here's what he said.
I love to watch her swim. She's got that loping-type stroke. A lot of people say she swims like a man. She doesn't swim like a man. She swims like Katie Ledecky, for crying out loud. Look at that. Still way ahead of the world record line. 100 meters left to go.
And so great moment there from Rowdy Gaines talking about Katie Ledecky. Nicole, you've been covering swimming. React to that. Tell us what it meant that he said that.
Oh, I think it's huge because so many people. So over the last 3 years, background, you know, I've been writing about Katie, getting to know her, and understanding that she was going to be phenomenal at these Olympics. And you know, for the last 3 years, so it's sort of like, here's Katie's backstory. Also, pay attention. She's the most dominant swimmer right now, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, speaking of Rowdy, I mean, he is very aware. He's fantastic as a commentator on swimming, but I remember talking to him at swimming trials, and he said that Katie Ledecky may be even more dominant than Michael at his heyday. So, honestly, maybe Michael should want to be the Katie Ledecky of men's swimming. But regardless of that, I mean, it is a sport that there we have had female stars. So I think that helps. And I knew that once people watched Katie and the way that she won these races, she was going to reach that level. I did, unfortunately, see a plenty of headlines saying Katie Ledecky is the female Michael Phelps.
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of, you know, some of the talk we're talking about headlines, you know, these are headlines, they're editors and maybe people who aren't, who don't even realize what they're doing is gendered and unfair to the female athletes themselves. But I do think that Katie Ledecky has so much respect. You know, the swimming community, I don't think, did that. There was one time where a headline was framed about her coach, Bruce Gemmel, you know, used to be an engineer, and he had all these patents, and the headline read that, like, his next project was Katie Ledecky, instead of, you know, taking away her agency and saying that this was his credit. And that is, you know, as you were talking about with Katinka Haas, that is a trend that we do see with female women who have male coaches. I think it happens in tennis coverage. It happens in other sports as well outside of the Olympics. But, I do think that at least for the swimming media that I was around, you know, we're used to seeing female stars. We knew Katie Ledecky would. The one thing I would say kind of tangentially is Missy Franklin had a very rough Olympics, very disappointed. She was basically in, you know, near tears throughout the week as it basically went the worst-case scenario for her. I almost felt that she obviously felt pressure coming into the games, but I think she almost even felt pressure boxed in as a happy, bubbly 17-year-old girl that she was and packaged that way in London.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like she felt like she couldn't struggle, or it was even more difficult to acknowledge that. She was, you know, she is a very positive person, but she was trying to smile through tears.
Wow.
And I think a lot of that had to do with the way she was covered 4 years ago in London.
Well, I want to try and see if we can get at least one or two calls in here. So let's turn to Corey, who's calling from West Roxbury. You're on the air, Corey.
Hi, I was just wondering if you guys could talk about the different outfit standards for men and women. It doesn't always seem to be based on anatomy. Thanks.
Interesting. This is the question that's really raised its head in sports, for example, like beach volleyball. Melissa, your thoughts?
Well, certainly beach volleyball, we don't really even have to talk about. It's been talked about so much. It really is the sport, it seems, that women watch because their husbands have it turned on. And, you know, there's pretty much one reason for that, and that's the outfits. But, you know, interestingly, this time around, I think we shouldn't forget the triumphs that also happened. And some of that had to do with the first athletes from some countries like Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan appearing. And when we want to talk about outfits, this was one of the first Olympics where women competed in Habibs.
Mm.
And I think we ought not to forget those things while we're talking about sort of the sexism. We ought to also applaud some of these other really amazing steps forward, even though the Saudi women, even though there were four of them, they were not officially on the Saudi team because you can't do that in Saudi Arabia. So they still were able to come by some mechanism that the Saudi kingdom arranged, but we're making small strides.
Yeah, I mean, we had a member of the Team USA fencing team competing in a hijab as well.
That's right.
Let's turn quickly, if we can, to Heather, who's calling from Easton. You just got a little bit of time, Heather.
Yeah, hijab. Sure. I just wanted to comment and say thank you to you guys for covering this topic. I was a former college athlete, and I love to watch the Olympics, and I was watching it with my sons, and I remember 4 years ago when watching beach volleyball and seeing, I think it was Kerry Walsh Jennings had just had a child not that long before, and they talked about her husband, how supportive he was and how great it was that he could watch the children so she could compete and have her career. And I was so frustrated, and I thought that was so sexist. You never hear the commentators talk about how great the wives are for taking care of all those men's children. Again, it's sort of framing the woman in reference to her man. That just not, she's an athlete, but they have to talk about how all the things her husband does, he's so supportive so she can compete.
I think we're hearing similar things about Michael Phelps this year, too.
Yeah. It's so funny you mentioned that, because this morning when I was sort of crowdsourcing this among my social media people to sort of get their sense of what was happening and what they saw, someone mentioned exactly that point. She said it was the moment where she felt like throwing the towel at the TV set. In fact, she might have.
Well, Nicole, we've just got a couple seconds left before we have to wrap up here. So last thought goes to you. I mean, I think the very fact that this conversation is happening in the culture means that progress is being made, but we still got a ways to go.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that Sally Jenkins column we referenced was a phenomenal look at this issue. There was also a New Yorker piece about criticism of the gymnastics coverage and the way that it was dumbed down and not very technical because of the assumption it was female fans, and that sort of changed the tone of Olympics coverage, and they did get more specific on special things that Simone Biles was doing that were going to cost her a tenth of a step or the way she lands or her toes were pointed, and stuff like that that matters for intelligent sports fans. So I think that people are listening, and it's good to have the conversation. I think the way to keep it going and going the right direction is what Melissa was mentioning earlier. It's just getting more women in newsrooms, get more women in editor, you know, headline, the editors write headlines.
Well, we're very grateful for having both of you today to help us keep this conversation going. Nicole Arbach, USA Today sports reporter who's covering the Olympics in Rio. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Melissa Ludke, formerly with Sports Illustrated. She writes for WBUR's Cognoscenti. Thank you so much.
Wonderful to be here.
I'm going to give the last word to Simone Biles, who said, "I'm not the next Usain Bolt or Michael Phelps. I'm the first Simone Biles." Couldn't have said it better. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.